Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What is the ideal number of human beings for the planet to support, and is it possible to maintain economic prosperity without ongoing growth? Currently, we are adding about 1 million human beings to the global population every 4.5 days. Most of us expect to live far longer than our ancestors would have dreamed, and those decades of material consumption will take a toll on the Earth's climate and its finite resources, effectively redefining, as my guest today will argue, the age-old notion of original sin. Journalist Alan Weissman is senior producer for Homelands Productions and author of the new book Countdown, Our Last Best Hope for a Future on Earth. Alan, welcome back to Think.
Thank you very much. What a pleasure.
The last time we spoke was about your book, The World Without Us, which imagined what would happen to the planet if the humans all died out or went away somehow. In this case, though, the thought experiment that you go through is based on real scenarios. Talk about that.
Well, you know, in The World Without Us, I theoretically wiped us off the map to see how nature would bounce back without our daily pressures, and it turns out rather speedily, much faster than we would possibly imagine. But what I wanted readers to come away with was not the idea of, oh, what a beautiful world without us, but isn't there a way that we can add ourselves back to that picture, only somehow in harmonious balance with the rest of the planet instead of in constant combat with it? And that prompted me to eventually approach this book, which is about, okay, what are we doing right now? How long can we keep doing it? Or what can we do to reach that possible balance? And it turns out that, as you said, 1 million more people every 4.5 days is really kind of excessive. We thought that the world was going to, that world population was going to finally level off this century at about 9.2 billion people, which is still 2 billion more than we have right now. But it turns out that that's not the case. The UN has revised all of its projections, and other demographic institutes agree that if we keep growing the way we're growing, we're on target for nearly 11 billion by the end of this century. And as I found out in the research for this book, a lot of the food scientists and people who are keeping us going on this planet don't believe that that's going to be possible. On the other hand, I also found out that it's really possible for us to do something about it, and surprisingly cheap.
So birth rates, as we know, are already falling, but it's sort of a double-edged sword that many more of us survive infancy than historically was true.
Yeah, there's two reasons why our population began doubling in the 20th century, and then it doubled again in the 20th century. One is that for nearly a century since the invention of the smallpox vaccine, we suddenly were controlling the natural forces that started, you know, that kept knocking our population back, so we barely grew for the first, you know, 98% of human history. We added things like eradication of epidemics, or, you know, like mosquitoes in the tropics, pasteurization of milk, and suddenly people were living longer, and this is very crucial. Most infants were surviving their infancy. Before, you know, most of them were dead by their fifth birthday. You know, imagine the pain that our ancestors went through. But now we don't have to deal with that. On the other hand, this means that more people survive to keep having more people. You know, and then in the right before World War One, we invented a way to greatly increase the plant life on this planet: artificial nitrogen fertilizer. When that became commercialized, there were only 2 billion of us on this planet, and we might be still near that number. It's calculated by several different sources that without artificial nitrogen fertilizer, 40% of us at least would not be alive today. The world simply couldn't produce enough plant life to support us all. But once again, all those people who survive didn't, you know, succumb to famine because we could produce all this food, and they're producing more people. And that is the reason why today, even though our growth rates are down, and we can talk about why, there's still so many of us now that population growth doesn't look like it's going to be peaking anytime soon.
In case it's not already entirely clear to people, you are not suggesting here that we stop trying to treat disease or prevent disease. You're saying we just need to look at our long-term population projections and do something about those.
Absolutely. I mean, look, any of us who are 40 or older, and that includes myself.
Me too.
We probably wouldn't be here because that was the life expectancy before we came up with all this great medical technology. And nobody is going to argue against that. But recently, the understanding has increased. For example, let's take Bill and Melinda Gates. They have been funding programs to eradicate malaria and HIV for a long time. But in recent years, they've come to realize that there's a responsibility inherent if we save all those lives. The responsibility being, how are we going to maintain stability on a planet that just keeps growing? So they are now putting a lot of resources and a lot of time and effort, and Melinda Gates speaks very eloquently about the need to couple life-saving medical technology with family planning.
So, Alan, one of the things you set out to do here is take us through a calculation of how many people the planet can ideally support. Talk about the kinds of data about human lifespan, about global material consumption that went into that equation.
Well, you know, I already mentioned one thing that greatly, you know, increased the number of people, artificial fertilizer. Mm-hmm. So if we were to cut that out of the mix, we'd be back pretty quickly, or we could... gradually phase.
Bless you.
Thank you. We could gradually phase it out and gradually bring our population down to a healthier balance with the rest of the planet. There have been other calculations based on how much total energy can we consume. And, you know, the International Panel on Climate Change just this past week came up with some figures about what our total carbon contribution can be before we get into real trouble. What they're saying is that we could burn, and this is in the history of humankind, about a trillion tons of carbon and still remain below a 2 degrees centigrade increase in average global temperature. Now, a lot of people are concerned that 2 degrees centigrade is way too much because already we see things bursting at the seams. I mean, we're at about a 0.7 to 0.8 degree increase right now, and our atmosphere is overloaded with carbon, and our seas are warming and they're acidifying, and we don't know what this is going to mean. What the IPCC said, though, that really got my attention, is that of that trillion tons of carbon, we've already burned more than half of it. So how much could we keep burning? Now, some calculations were done about 20 years ago by John Holdren, who is President Obama's science advisor. He was a physicist at Berkeley and head of the National Academy of Sciences. And he figured at the rate we were burning carbon, and by the way, we're burning it faster than even back then, that if you divided it out equitably around the world, you know, we could and really reduced the amount through efficiency that we are all using. Theoretically, you know, maybe it would support between 2 and 3 billion of us. And he was not advocating any draconian reduction. He was simply throwing those numbers out. So we would think about it and think about what we have to do. You know, this is 1993, and he was hoping that we would put so much of our effort into developing renewable substitutes for carbon. But as I said, we just haven't done a really good job of that. And it may be because there are limitations on how much solar and wind can practically do to run all of our vehicles and all of our industries and our cities and our Chinas and our Indias. So we may need, in order to limit carbon up there, we may have to start limiting the number of people who are emitting that carbon. And that does not mean culling the population. It just simply means recruiting fewer of us to take our places in the future by having fewer children.
So if we had that 2 to 3 billion, we wouldn't necessarily have to have the distribution we have now between the very wealthy and the very poor. If we had that few people, given the technology we have today, we could all live and consume somewhat like Europeans?
You know, that's what I was really interested in finding out. Is there a lifestyle that the majority of the world would find acceptable? And a European lifestyle, they're much more energy efficient than we are in the United States. And yet we go over to Europe, and it looks pretty nice. Mm-hmm. Yes, they've got their economic problems right now, but certainly so do we. And it's still quite livable. And a lot of South Asians and Africans would certainly aspire to a European lifestyle. That's why a lot of them are trying to immigrate there. So that's what interests me. Now, legislating social equality, look, that's never happened very easily in this world. You know, Jesus Christ talked about there always being poor among us. But are there ways that rather than trying to enforce morality on the planet to share and share alike, that we could move towards it better than we are right now? Well, I propose one in this book, which also would help bring our population levels down naturally in a very acceptable way, and also a way that would become, would present an enormous resource to this society that we are overlooking to the extent that we could take advantage of it. And what I'm referring to is the best contraceptive of all, which is educating females. Every country I went to, and I went to 21 countries to research this book for reasons we can talk about, rich country, poor country, educated women, you get them through high school, and overwhelmingly they're going to have two children or fewer. Of course there are exceptions, but the fewer, you know, it makes us all average out to two. And the reasons are sort of elementary. A woman tends to postpone her childbearing while she's still in school. And then once she's out of school, she's got something interesting and very useful and economically providential for her family and society to do. And you can't do that with seven kids hanging on your apron strings. So only in some rare exceptions do educated women ever have more than two. And at that point, those women with their education can be contributing to the labor force, and also educated women means more equality in the world. You know, it's an unequal world when we have gender discrimination, and so many of the poor in the world are female. If we educate them, this wealth distribution will begin to reach, head towards equilibrium. It certainly won't ever happen if we don't do that.
My guest is Alan Weissman. He is senior producer for Homelands Productions and author of the new book, Countdown, Our Last Best Hope for a Future on Earth. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. We'll be back in a couple minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. With more than 40 classes starting in October, from landscape painting to intelligent investing on the Dallas and Plano campuses, smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist Alan Weissman. He is senior producer for Homelands Productions and author of the new book Countdown, Our Last Best Hope for a Future on Earth. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Alan, let's talk about why you went around the world to look at ideas about population control, population growth. When you hear population control on a national scale, people's minds instantly go to China. But that is not the only country that has wrestled with this.
No, and some countries have actually done better than China. You know, I boiled this whole book down to four questions. How many people can fit on the planet without tipping it over? The converse, how much nature do we need in order to guarantee our own survival? What are the essential species that we depend on? And then the third one, which speaks to your question, is if we knew that number is, you know, no more or even fewer than what we have right now, is there a way that the majority of the world's cultures and peoples and political systems, religions, etc., might find it acceptable? Is there something in their histories or liturgies that point to a time when managing their growth became important in moments of crisis? And as you state, you know, the one-child policy in China, yeah, there are 400 million fewer Chinese as a result of it, but it was so harsh and coercive that most people absolutely won't accept it. Most countries and cultures won't accept it, and most Chinese really didn't like it very much either. So I had to go to all these places. You know, I just heard the promo for Broadcast of the World later on in your station, and they're going to be talking about Iran. Iran is one of the countries that I went to, and I spent 2 weeks there because, surprisingly to most Americans, Iran has had a program that actually brought population growth rate down to replacement, meaning two people produce two kids, a year faster than China. The reason why they did that was, first, they were doing the opposite. Right after the Islamic Revolution, they were attacked by Iraq, Saddam Hussein. He was after this oil-rich province on their border. And Iraq had a lot of backing from NATO. He had sophisticated weaponry. So Iran basically used numbers. The Ayatollah asked every fertile woman in Iran to get pregnant and help build a 20-million-man army to defend the nation. And for a while, they had the highest birth rate probably in recorded human history. But then the war ended after 8 years, and they realized that they were going to have this generation within 10 years that were going to be entering the job market, and their economy would nowhere near be developed enough to employ them all. And a country with a lot of unemployed, frustrated young men becomes a very destabilized country very quickly. In fact, what I just described is Pakistan, which is another country I went, which, by the way, for your listeners, Pakistan's a country the size of Texas. You guys have 26 million people. Pakistan's got 195 million people, and it's growing out of control. By the year 2030, they're going to have 395 million people, which is more than the United States, and it's still going to be the size of Texas. So in Iran, what they did was institute a program that wasn't coercive. They said everybody can have the number of children that they want. The only thing that they required was that every couple that was going to get married attend premarital classes, and you could do it in a mosque or in a health center. And in those classes, among other things, they discussed how much does it cost to raise a child, to educate a child, to, you know, feed and clothe them. And they coupled that with across-the-board contraceptive services for free. I talked to OBGYNs who would go horseback into these little villages bringing pills and condoms, but also bringing surgical tools to perform vasectomies or tubal ligations. There was a fatwa issued by the current Ayatollah saying that there's nothing in the Quran that says if wisdom dictates that you have the number of children that you can be responsible for, that you can't partake of any of these technologies. And again, they encouraged women to study, because a woman who studies postpones her childbearing, and then she's got something interesting, important to do with her life that she can't do if she's got so many kids clinging to her. Within 9 years, they brought themselves down to replacement rate, and they've gone down below replacement rate. Now, in recent years, just while I was there 2 years ago, suddenly they did an about-face, because they're concerned about, oh, what's going to happen to the economy when we have all these old people and fewer young people paying into the coffers. But that's a problem that I found out in other places we can learn how to deal with.
And Japan is one of those places that is definitely dealing with this right now. They have a large aging population, a smaller youth population to support them and to care for them. Can you talk about some of the ways that Japan is looking at solutions to this?
Well, right when I was there, they also realized that their limitations were even more severe than they thought they were, because they had this terrible tragedy. And, you know, we think of the radiation, and we think of the loss to port facilities and, you know, coastal habitation in Fukushima. What we don't know over here oftentimes is that Fukushima was the fruit basket of Iran. It has tremendous soils, but now those soils are irradiated, and they're just not capable. You know, they can't eat food from up there. So Japan is faced with a shrinking population and a shrinking resource base. The reason why they're shrinking is that at the end of World War II, they had lost the war, they were poverty-stricken, and they were experiencing a baby boom for the same reason we were. Their soldiers had come home, but suddenly they couldn't feed everybody. And finally, in an emergency measure, this was before the days of the birth control pill, Japan legalized abortion. And women everywhere were partaking of that because they couldn't stand watching their babies die of hunger. So what we have now is a much smaller baby boom population than the previous generation. And as that previous generation now begins to pass on, there are going to be many fewer Japanese. So I met economists there who are wringing their hands over this and saying, how will we take care of all these people, and we're not going to have a big enough labor force? But I met other economists, one in particular, who was a real visionary with a major policy institute there, who sees an inevitable reorganizing of the country. It's going to be away from these heavy industry, crowded port cities, because as the countryside vacates, you know, many people are dying off, and land and property and houses are even becoming cheap. Younger people are drifting across the land, and they represent a workforce where more nimble, lighter industries are going to be able to settle to produce consumer goods. As demand lowers, labor will still it'll even be more valuable, and wages will probably stay up there, but working hours will gradually decrease. And prosperity over time will become redefined not by how many consumer toys can you afford in those precious hours between coming home from work and falling asleep, to having more leisure time and be able to enjoy a world that is increasingly more habitable because it's not as crowded. So this is an adjustment that really makes sense. As he pointed out to me, right now the conventional economists are talking about, let's rebuild all the ports that were destroyed by the tsunami. And he answers, you know, that'll take 20 years to do, and in the meantime, our population is coming down, and a quarter of those fishermen are going to be gone. We don't need to rebuild all these facilities. What we need to do is gradually downsize, and we can learn how to absorb the changes, over the next few decades, and readjust to a much more stable economy that isn't like a chain letter or a Ponzi scheme dependent on constant growth.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Tim in Dallas. Hi, Tim.
Hey there. Wonderful topic and show as always. So here's my thought, and this won't be shocking, I'm sure. You know, I wouldn't, you know, presume to speak for other, you know, cultures or countries and the people that live there and the way that they tend to plan or to deal with things. But, you know, here in America, it's pretty well known that we tend to be a pretty reactionary group of people. We don't like to plan for things because, in many cases, in my opinion, it means that someone's freedom is going to be infringed upon. And so that tends to go down in flames. And so it usually ends up taking some sort of cataclysmic disaster, whether it's a hurricane or a flood or a financial collapse, that forces us to make the changes that we should have been doing all along. And, you know, not to assume that the rest of the world thinks the same way, but if we were to just put that situation that we're speaking about today on America, you know, it seems to me that we're heading in the same direction. And I'm not saying I have an answer for it. It's just a pretty spooky and scary, you know, scenario.
Well, what do you think, Alan Weisman?
Well, I think you're right. It's a scary scenario, and that's why I wrote a book that isn't arguing for population control from an advocacy point of view, because population is such a loaded question. You know, it's kind of a place where social science and natural science collide, and it's very hard for us to be objective. Look, we can be objective when we're looking at a national park, and we realize that we have to keep prey and predator in balance. Otherwise, the ecosystem can crash if one of them gets out of whack. But when we're looking at our own species, it's really, really difficult. Like every other species in the history of biology, we are designed to make copies of ourselves to ensure, survival of our kind. And it's a hard thing to think about. And yet, I show many examples in this book of countries that realize that this is for the best. Thailand realized that they could never possibly support all their people. And so they instituted a program much different from Iran's, but again, it's voluntary. They kind of made a national joke about condoms, and condoms suddenly were available everywhere. There was this cops and rubbers brigade where a policeman would hand you out a condom on the street corner. And they used television soap operas, and they use condom inflating contests. I mean, it's a really funny story, but in a country whose economy is partly dependent on a sex industry, they came down below replacement rate. Italy, which is a Catholic country, and it houses the Vatican, which is another place that I go, and there's some very interesting encounters in the Vatican to discuss this issue. They have simply, there was no plan whatsoever. They simply did a really good job of educating their women, and educated Catholic women overwhelmingly choose to use contraception so they can use their education. And Italy has one of the lowest fertility rates on the planet, and so does Catholic Spain. So there are ways that this can be done. If those countries can foresee it and plan for it, so can we. Now, part of the reason that our population grows is because of immigration, and most of these people are coming from rural societies that have large families. You need a lot of kids to take care of things on the farm. But they're now moving into cities, even in their own countries. Today, more than half the people on Earth live in cities. And a child is no longer an economic asset in a city. Basically, you know, other than being lovable, a child is a liability because it costs you money. They don't really contribute much to the family's economy. So I interview immigrants in many countries, Muslim immigrants in Europe. They may have come from a family of eight back in Bangladesh, but these girls who are getting educated right now, they don't want more than two children, and that's going to be making a difference. I don't see governments doing this. That's very intrusive. Though governments can really help, as our government does, make contraception available to the world. I see people making this choice for themselves. And yeah, the extremists who are concerned about, you know, is this going to just, you know, just justify abortion? I understand their concerns, but I'll say two things about that. One, evangelical women tend to use birth control just about as much as anybody. And if universal contraception were available, several demographic institutes have worked on these numbers, it would lower the number of abortions every year by 26 million. That's the best anti-abortion policy that I've ever heard of.
What do you think, Alan, that the long-term repercussions will be of that interview with Pope Francis of the Catholic Church being made public, that he wants to move the Church's focus, at least, away from issues like abortion and birth control and the proscriptions against them to focus on other things?
Well, I think that it was very generous of the Pope to say that because, you know, he realizes that in any religion, people who are so strict by the book, they start to value their rules more than they value, in this case, Christ's teaching, which is to love one another. Will it make a big difference? The overwhelming number of Catholics in the world are already using birth control. I mean, you know, the Vatican is this city that's only 110 acres, and nearly every one of its 1,000 residents are male. And yet it's surrounded by Catholic Italy, you know, where 98% of Catholic women in the United States have used or currently are using birth control. These are the choices that women want to make. I spend time in the Philippines, which is a country where the Catholic Church still has a lot of power, and the government has finally passed the reproductive health bill this year after 40 years of trying, and it's now it's hung up in the Supreme Court because the Catholic bishops are really, really pushing hard. But I went to many communities that are doing an end run around it, and they've got their own family planning programs because 90% of the protein in the Philippines comes from the sea. And
you know, let me jump in, Alan. We have to take a quick break. My guest is journalist Alan Weissman. His new book is called Countdown, Our Last Best Hope for a Future on Earth. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. With more than 40 classes starting in October, from landscape painting to intelligent investing on the Dallas and Plano campuses, smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with journalist Alan Weissman, who is senior producer for Homelands Productions and author of the new book Countdown, Our Last Best Hope for a Future on Earth. Join us by emailing think@kera.org or call 1-800-933-5372. Alan, before the break, you had begun talking about the Philippines, where the population is heavily dependent on the ocean as a source of protein.
Right, and I visited many coastal villages where people have figured out that you have to keep the number of fishermen in balance with the fish stocks out there. So they are instituting family planning and setting up nature preserves for the fish so they can keep reproducing naturally, and things are coming back into balance there. But another point I want to make about your question about religion, mm-hmm, in the Catholic Church, I learned something extraordinary when I was interviewing the head of state family planning and Planned Parenthood in Costa Rica. And she explained that Costa Rica, which once had one of the world's highest reproductive rates and now is below replacement rate, that came about because of evangelical Christianity. The churches, just when the birth control pill was becoming available, the evangelical churches realized that there was a vulnerability in the Catholic message to women that they were going to hell if they used contraception. And they started broadcasting on the radio that in our church, God loves you for having the number of children that you can, you know, that you can take care of. And this woman, who, by the way, is Jehovah's Witness herself, says that so much of the abandonment of the Catholic Church for evangelical Christianity in Latin America, which is projected to make Catholicism a minority by the end of the century, is due to the fact that women realize that God still loves them if, you know, if they make their own decisions in this church rather than a church that makes them feel guilty. And, you know, nothing against my Catholic friends, but, you know, the Catholic Church has kind of painted itself into a corner called papal infallibility. They have been preaching this for a long time. I go to the Pontifical Academy of Sciences, which issued a paper, much to dismay, the dismay of John Paul II, saying that given our medical technology today, it's unconscionable to be having more than 2.3 children or advising people to keep growing because the earth can't take all of these people. The church can't admit that it was wrong because that would deny papal infallibility. So they're sort of stuck there, but most Catholics on earth, they can figure this one out for themselves, and they can still be devout, but perhaps not to the liking of some of the most conservative bishops.
I want to talk a little bit more, Alan, about what our economy would look like and how people could continue to thrive in a much less populated world. People in this country are familiar with what's taking place right now in a city like Detroit, which feels a little unsettled, and you know, the empty real estate is of concern. How would we cope with an entire country that looked like Detroit?
Well, you know, I was on the phone with a Detroit radio station earlier today, and we were talking about just this thing. At first, it's a shock to watch a city vacate and implode. And then you start to see that those vacant lots actually start looking pretty nice when they start greening up. And then people realize that, well, real estate's suddenly a lot cheaper and it's more affordable, and those vacant lots can turn into not just weed patches, but they can turn into gardens. And suddenly it becomes cheaper to feed yourself, and it becomes more pleasant and fun. Kids get engaged. I've written about this before. You show a kid in an inner city how to grow a carrot, and they're so fascinated by it, suddenly they like to eat carrots. So it becomes a healthier population. A city and a world with more breathing space in it is simply going to be so much more pleasant. You know, I have found that everywhere I go and talk about this, that people, they miss something, no matter how old they are. They miss something that they used to have, and that was a place that they could get away to that wasn't that far from home, and they could go out there and they could walk under the trees, or they could chop firewood, or, you know, they could watch birds, or if they like to hunt, they could shoot birds. But just a beautiful place to go that today is buried underneath, you know, condominiums and industrial parks in asphalt. And by the way, most of the cities in the world are situated where they are because there was good agricultural land nearby. And so we've been covering some of our best land. It just doesn't make sense to keep doing this. And if suddenly we weren't as numerous as we are, this would be a much more affordable world. You know, I oftentimes note that even people who supported the election of Barack Obama, many of them became very disillusioned because they thought he was going to be another FDR and there was going to be a New Deal and everything would get solved. Well, you know, politics are complicated, but one thing that I never hear analyzed out there is that FDR had only one-third the number of people to take care of with social programs as Barack Obama is trying to do. At a certain point, too many of us, it's just too much of a good thing, and it just becomes unmanageable. And shrinking down, yeah, it's going to be shocking in some ways, but then we're going to find out that there's lots of opportunity, as they're starting to discover in Japan. And it just can be a much more breathable space to live in.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Theron in Plano. Hi, Theron.
Good afternoon, you all, and a beautiful Texas day it is.
Sure is.
Years ago, I got the latest issue of Journal Science, and I came across Garrett Hardin's writing titled The Tragedy of the Commons, and it has lived with me for all these years. He essentially said that that problems cannot be solved by technical means, and his big thing was the control of the human population, which is exactly what you all are talking about on this present show. But more interesting is that he said that children of improvident or impoverished parents starve to death, comma, if overbreeding was its own punishment, comma, then there would be no public interest in controlling of the breeding of families. And he really blames the welfare state for what's going on with in the world's population.
What do you think, Alan?
Well, the welfare state can really be problematic because you get generations of people who are used to being on welfare. And that's really, you know, that takes away the incentive. I mean, we need to go no farther than our, you know, our reservations for Native Americans who we have maintained. And it's not a pretty sight, unfortunately. There, you know, there's just not much incentive, and there's a lot of alcoholism and a lot of social problems. On the other hand, if the kind of welfare that we are giving is the incentive to get educated. You know, I was in just horrific places in Pakistan where some private businessmen got tired of the government programming that was producing schools that just turned out to be bureaucratic cesspools where teachers would only show up just to collect their salaries and kids weren't getting educated. They started a series, there's over 400 of them now, in the poorest places in Pakistan, and they made them co-educational, so boys would grow up alongside of girls in class, and they learned to respect them, and so girls would have the same chances as boys. Education, that opportunity, and by the way, they make those families pay. They pay almost a pittance, but symbolically, that gets the family engaged with the process. They get to get them invested in the process. And when they get into secondary school, all those kids in their schools get paired with a mentor in a profession that they would like to become part of someday. So the girls who start following around flight attendants or nurses or female doctors or school teachers, they see that these women, in order to have jobs, they don't have a house full of kids. They've got two maximum, and they get the picture. So I think that there is the kind of welfare that really is useful, and that is simply having a good educational system and also making contraception available out there. It's, you know, it's a technology that we've already mastered. It's not, you know, trying to save the world by coming up with some miracle form of clean energy, which there may be physical limitations on, you know, how much we can run all of our cities and our industries with, you know, solar and wind power. And even if we could, we're not doing a good job of implementing it. But contraception is really cheap. We could provide it to the entire world for about $8.5 billion, which is what, per year, which is what our country was spending in Iraq and Afghanistan per month. This is something doable, and it would make such a difference.
I don't want to get too sidetracked here. I would note that a lot of people might disagree with your characterization that Native Americans are sort of the recipients of vast government largesse, and that government handouts are the reason for the problems on Indian reservations.
No, there's tremendous reasons. I mean, you know, these were vanquished people, and the systems that are in place on so many Indian reservations, the educational systems, etc. Yeah, they're dysfunctional. It's a long and sad story, and it's a story that I hope we never repeat again.
Is it worth considering limiting tax credits for American parents who have multiple children?
Well, I think that, let's take a country like Israel. that for a long time they have had those kinds of tax credits, and finally even a conservative prime minister like Benjamin Netanyahu had to just kill that. It used to be, you know, you got more money for every kid that you had, and now it's so crowded there. Now, David Ben-Gurion thought that the Holy Land could hold 6 million people. The British before him said, oh, maximum 2.5 million. He thought Jewish ingenuity could stretch that to 6 million. Well, today, between the Jordan and the Mediterranean, there's 12 million people, and they've had to pull those continued tax credits. You know, they flatlined them now. They haven't taken them away completely. It's just counterproductive for us to pay people to have more people, because every single person on this earth has to be fed, has to be sheltered, needs infrastructure and energy, and that simply isn't, you know, it just isn't conceivable that you can keep doing that on a planet that keeps growing.
So talk about this, Alan. Having children at or maybe just below the replacement rate is one thing, and that may correspond with what women in particular sort of naturally desire if they're in control of these decisions. That's a very different thing from having only one child per family, which is what would be necessary if we were to get down to that 2 to 3 billion figure that you've quoted. Is that more of a cultural shift, do you think, than anything else?
You know, a one-child policy isn't going to fly in most of the world because, you know, we're creatures like any other species on this planet. We're designed to both try to survive as long as we can and to make copies of ourselves. So our, you know, our species, and in our case, our cultures, keep surviving ahead of us. It seems like a very unnatural act to limit it. But at a certain point, you know, we absolutely have, you know, in a national park, we know that you have to keep predator and prey in balance with one another. But when you look at your own species, it's hard to be objective about that. You know, if it's not going to fly to tell people just to have one child. But if you tell them it's okay to have two, a lot of them are going to have one or fewer. And so our population will go down more gradually, but it will be headed in the right direction, and the world will become gradually more livable. And that will give us time, by the way, to make that adjustment to a sustainable economy that doesn't depend on a Ponzi scheme of constant growth, which simply defies physical reality.
Journalist Alan Weisman is senior producer for Homelands Productions and author of the new book Countdown, Our Last Best Hope for a Future on Earth. Alan, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me again. Appreciate it.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer, and Christine McConnell produces our podcast. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can find me on Twitter. I'm at Chris Boyd Think, and you can contact us via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.